This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor, and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Yes, 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 it's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths and taking names, and boy, what an interesting few days it's been. Fortunately for me, fortunately for all you Buzzkillers out there, we have Dr. W. Joseph Campbell on the line, who's a professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and more importantly, perhaps for our purposes, is an expert on opinion polling. Professor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Professor, it's great to be on your show. Thank you so much for your invitation.
Hey, well, it's great to have you. It's great to have someone talk about this, especially now because, as we know, in the social media and the Twitter sphere and everything, in the aftermath of the election, people are saying things like the pollsters have a lot to answer for and things like that, because so many of the predictions for the 2020 presidential election were, shall we say, exaggerated.
Absolutely. They do have a lot to answer for. And we had in 2020 yet another polling surprise in a presidential election. It's not the first. But, you know, Professor, these polling errors, these polling failures, these polling surprises in presidential elections have a way of being like Tolstoy's unhappy family.
Yeah.
They're all unhappy in their own way. They all fail or they surprise us in their own way. There's seldom a polling error or polling failure that duplicates itself. We've never, for example, had a replay of the 1948 Dewey defeats Truman election, which was a huge polling embarrassment for the polling industry, and it's remembered to this day as an epic polling failure.
So are you saying that every time there's a polling problem, like the Dewey defeats Truman one is a big one because Gallup more or less stopped polling a month before the election or whatever it was, and polling companies then learn from their mistakes, but then they make a whole bunch of other mistakes as the decades go on. So it's almost a never-ending problem of finding new mistakes to make.
Let me offer another metaphor, and okay. It may be a cliche, but it's sort of like the general fighting the last war.
Right.
And in 1948, after the polling failure of that year, George Gallup and Elmo Roper and Archibald Crossley, who were the three major national pollsters at the time, turned very, very cautious in 1952, 4 years later, the Eisenhower-Stevenson presidential campaign. They were saying, this is a very close race. This could go either way. Stevenson's coming on strong at the end. He could take over the lead. He could win, depending on how undecided voters break. And there are all kinds of these qualifications and characterizations of a close race, because it didn't want to be burned again. They didn't want to have this bold prediction that as akin to which they had made in 1948. So in 1952, they're very, very cautious, and Eisenhower wins in a landslide. He wins 39 out of the 48 states, and it's not even close. In fact, the states that George Gallup said looked really close, California among them, really weren't. I mean, Eisenhower won these close states by 10 percentage points. It was a blowout. So the pollsters were wrong again, and yet they were wrong for a different reason. It wasn't the same. It wasn't a replay of 1948. It was a landslide that none of them anticipated, a landslide unforeseen. So that's another typology, if you will, of polling error, of polling failure in presidential elections.
Well, maybe let's give the Buzzkillers a little taste of the half dozen or so most important types of polling failures before we go through the chronology of how many there were. And by the way, I've wonderfully surprised, and I always love this stuff because it's good for the show to learn how many mistakes there were and how much myth busting I've got to do. But what are the sort of classic types of mistakes that they've made so far since polling began?
Well, we've just talked about landslides unforeseen, and that is a separate class of polling failure, polling error in presidential elections, and that we saw in 1952. To a lesser extent, somewhat lesser extent, we saw it in 1980 when Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan in what was supposed to be a close race, but Reagan wins in a near landslide. It wasn't quite the landslide of Eisenhower's victory in 1982, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, it sort of came close to that. And we've also talked about the epic polling failure of 1948 when all the polls got it wrong. And the press picked up on the narrative of the pollsters, and they got it wrong too, underscoring again how polling failure often equates to journalistic failure. And the pundits in 1948 got it wrong too. So across the board, there was this total breakdown, this total error. And we've really never seen a replay of 1948 in presidential elections since then. There's another typology in which venerable, well-known pollsters singularly and dramatically get it wrong.
Yeah.
And this typology is pretty clear in the 1936 presidential election between Franklin Roosevelt and Alf Landon.
Mm-hmm.
And in that election, the Literary Digest magazine was, again, polling the country as to who was likely to win this presidential race. They had done it in the four previous presidential elections and had gotten it right. In fact, in one case, in 1932, they were like within a percentage point or two of getting the actual popular vote percentage. So the Literary Digest magazine, this venerable old line magazine that had been launched in the 1890s, it was regarded as this uncanny oracle of public opinion research. And in 1936, they launched their poll again. And it was a massive mail-in poll. They would send out 10 million postcard ballots to people across the country, drawn from mailing lists of all sorts. And from those, from that sample of 10 million people, they received return postcards from 2.3 million people.
Oh.
A huge sample, Professor, a huge sample.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they calculated it. They tabulated all the results, added it all up, which took a long time. And they finally announced a few days before the 1936 election that Alf Landon, the Republican governor of Kansas, was ahead of Roosevelt and looked destined to win the election comfortably, that he was going to oust this incumbent president and make Franklin Roosevelt a one-term president. 2 days later in the election, Franklin Roosevelt rolls up one of the largest landslides in American political history. He wipes out Alf Landon, wins every state in the country but two, Maine and Vermont. And the percentage of his victory was on the order of 20, 24 percentage points.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Literary Digest missed by 19.9 percentage points. It was a huge miss. And the Literary Digest was in financial trouble at the time anyway, keeping in mind that the 1930s was the time of American depression, economic depression. And it was the Literary Digest was in tough shape anyway, in rough shape. And it went out of business a couple years later, not because of the poll, but that was another factor in pushing the Literary Digest into its grave. So then we have that typology of a venerable, well-known, well-respected pollster who singularly gets it wrong and does so in dramatic fashion. And also 1936 is important to note that this is the dawning of modern opinion research when George Gallup and Archibald Crossley and Elmo Roper initiated their election polls. It was the first time they polled a presidential election. So you had this clash of pollsters in 1936, the venerable Literary Digest, which had its mail-in poll, and then you had Gallup and others who were using smaller samples. They were using the mails too, but they were also sending people out to interview harder to reach voters. So their sample sizes were smaller and pointed to, their polls pointed to Franklin Roosevelt's victory by varying degrees of accuracy. I mean, Gallup did not get that election in 1936 spot on, but he was pointing to the right winner. And so this clash of polls in 1936 left Gallup, Roper, and Crossley sort of as the dominant pollsters at the time, and the Literary Digest disappears pretty soon afterwards. So we have that typology. And we've also seen exit polls, how they have gone awry in presidential elections. Notably in 2004, exit polls are conducted typically at polling places when interviewers ask voters who've just left the polling place to fill out a questionnaire about their polling, about their voting preferences.
Right.
And in 2004, exit polling was being done again. It was not the first time exit polls were conducted in presidential elections, but it was a major embarrassment that year because the exit polls, 2004, pointed to a clear, if somewhat narrow, victory for John Kerry
in his
race against President George W. Bush.
Yeah, I remember that clearly, yeah.
And everybody was believing this. George Bush in his memoir talks about brooding in the White House on election day 2004, thinking that he, like his father, had been repudiated at the polls.
Yeah, one termer, yeah.
And so he thought he was done for. He thought the exit polls were accurate and he was done. And John Kerry and his staff also tended to believe the exit polls. In fact, at 7 o'clock on election night, 2004, one of his top campaign aides, a guy named Bob Shrum, turned to Kerry, looked him in the eye and said, "Mr. President."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thinking that these exit polls were spot on and we're going to be delivering the victory to Kerry. As it turned out, Bush wins by nearly 3 percentage points. So it was a major loss, a major misfire for exit polls. So that's another typology. And then we saw in 2016, Professor, when the polls in key states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania principally, Florida a little bit, surprisingly and unexpectedly went to Donald Trump. The polls in those states indicated that Trump had little, if any, chance of winning, and yet he did. He carried them all narrowly and enough to win the presidency and deny Hillary Clinton electoral college victory. And that was another type of polling failure where state polls can disrupt the national expectation.
Yeah, right, right.
It looks like in 2020, we might even have another typology of poll failure. I don't know what the name of it would be yet, but it's certainly different from what we've seen in the past, certainly different from 2016.
Well, it seems to be the difference is that it's overwhelming expectation. As late as 3 or 4 days before the election, people were talking about, say, Amy McGrath in Kentucky being close to Mitch McConnell and Jamie Harrison in South Carolina being close to Lindsey Graham. And McConnell and Graham won in cakewalks. It's like this over-expectation. It's like this almost wishing it to be true. And therefore, do they grasp it at the most positive polls, or are they just getting the numbers wrong, or are people lying to them? It's just astounding.
You're right. It's only a few days after the election, and it's going to take a while for pollsters and others to parse out just what happened. But maybe we can call it the election failure of the blue wave or something like that, the blue wave that wasn't, because that was the expectation, broadly speaking, that Joe Biden was going to win in a blowout and lead his Democratic Party to an overwhelming victory that would take control of the U.S. Senate and boost their majority in the House of Representatives. And
yeah, that didn't happen.
It looks like the Republicans are going to keep control of the U.S. Senate, and the Republicans have bolstered their minority in the House of Representatives. And you mentioned Lindsey Graham. And Mitch McConnell is winning what were supposed to be fairly close races in their states. And look at Susan Collins in Maine.
Yeah.
I mean, she won easily. You talk about a cakewalk. I think that was a real cakewalk, a surprising cakewalk, because all the polls, Professor, in Maine had her losing, and by substantial margins in some cases. And yet she wins. I mean, that is an astonishing turnabout and an astonishing polling error. That's part and parcel of this blue wave that wasn't.
Right. Are there any ways we can say, and by we I mean you, can say that, okay, well, again, it's too early to be able to determine things. We need all the numbers and things need to settle down. But that the Lindsey Graham Senate race looks like the mistakes the pollsters made there look like the Truman mistakes, or they look like the Alf Landon mistakes, or they look like the Carter Reagan closeness mistake. The pollsters seem to be making the same mistakes over and over again, just choosing one of the different typologies?
Interesting idea. It could resemble the landslide that was not foreseen typology.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And we saw that in 1952 for sure with the Adlai Stevenson loss to General Dwight Eisenhower, and it was also replayed a little bit, not exactly, but a bit of a replay in 1980 when Reagan won fairly easily, comfortably, in a near landslide that was never foreseen by pollsters. And I think that's true in although the final numbers are hardly in yet, but in Maine it looks like Susan Collins is up by 9 points or so. That may not be a landslide by everyone's definition, but it's close enough, and it certainly was an unforeseen outcome. It was an unforeseen outcome. So, again, it's a state-level flaw, too, so it brings in 2016 elements as well, which was a failure of the polls in key states that upset the national expectations.
There's something else that's important in terms of the broadest analysis that you have, in that you say there's not only a polling mistake, but there's sort of a journalistic error aspect to all this, in that the journalists rely too much on the pollsters as if they're, you know, a scientist tracking the trajectory of an electron, when we should treat them more like weathermen.
You know, that is an excellent analogy. I really like that.
Oh, well.
And it's true. In many respects, it's treated with more precision. Polling numbers are treated with more precision than they probably deserve.
Right.
But journalists deal in ambiguity and uncertainty and deception all the time. I mean,
right, yeah.
People were trying to spin them if they can. And so polling numbers or statistics of any kind really offer an impression, an illusion of precision, that these are hard, fast, cold numbers. They're not going to be deceptive necessarily. At least they don't seem deceptive on their face. So that's one reason they've been so beguiling to journalists over the years. And historians, by the way, have found evidence or have found reports about proto straw polls in presidential elections as far back as 1824, when John Quincy Adams was running against Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay. A guy named Crawford, it was a four-way race that wound up being decided by the House of Representatives. But there were polls being done and being reported in newspapers in North Carolina and Pennsylvania as long ago as 1824. So that shows the profound attraction that journalists have for polls and for trying to find precision in what is an uncertain atmosphere, an uncertain campaign. And many polling organizations, many news organizations are polling organizations.
Oh, okay.
I mean, not big time polling organizations, but the New York Times and CBS News and CNN, ABC News, the Washington Post all have polling operations or commission public opinion polls.
Yeah.
Including in presidential elections. So they do this because it helps round out their news report, and it also adds depth and dimension to what they're reporting. And polls, like journalism, you know, really emphasize and value timeliness, significance, accuracy, of course. And so these are some of the dominant primary values in American journalism that are reflected as well in the polling industry. So there is this symbiotic relationship, but it's an uneasy relationship at the same time, because when polls go wrong, journalists are prone to bash the polls, as we've seen in the aftermath of the 2020 election. I mean, a number, the Atlantic, Politico, even the Washington Post were coming out with strong criticisms of the polling industry. And there's been some suggestion that the polling industry is doomed.
I've seen that one. Yeah. Yeah.
After these back-to-back misfires in 2016 and 2020, that it's going to go away. And I think that's ridiculous. That's nonsensical. Because if election polling were so vulnerable to back-to-back mistakes, it would have disappeared after the 1952 error, which followed the 1948 error. So those back-to-back polling failures were even more pronounced and prominent than the ones in 2016 and 2020, sort of on a scale of of failure. That those two are arguably a lot higher than 2016 and 2020. So I don't see how this industry is going to be doomed by back-to-back polling errors or surprises in 2016 and 2020. It's a multi-billion dollar industry too, Professor. And far more research is being done using surveys in terms of market research and consumer preferences and public policy issues. That is far more extensive than the comparatively narrow slice of election polling. So this industry is a huge industry, of which election polling makes up only a sliver, a small sliver. It's a high profile sliver, but it's nonetheless pretty small in comparison to what everything else that goes on in that business.
Is there any sense, have scholars of this done a a sort of long-range statistical analysis, how many times have they gotten it wrong versus how many times have they gotten it right? I mean, do we wig out because of these failures and mistakes because they're relatively rare, or is it a 50-50 thing, or is it like weathermen? You know, they miss it by a little bit, but not, you know, rains and you can't play golf today, so you play golf tomorrow, but does it really matter?
Great questions. There has been research done to get a sense of how polling has done over the years and in terms of being close to or far off from election results. And some of these studies have suggested, although there's a lot more work to be done, that that polling has gotten better over the years. And I think that that's probably in broad brush terms pretty accurate, because we don't see 19-point polling mistakes too often anymore, as we saw with the Literary Digest
in
1936.
Yeah.
But then again, there were some polls in 2020, like the Quinnipiac University poll, presidential race had Biden ahead by 10 or 11 percentage points. And he's ahead maybe by 2 or 3. So it's looking like it could be a 6-7 point miss there. And that's pretty sizable these days, especially since polling has become more sophisticated and the techniques have become more numerous than what the Literary Digest was doing, what, some 80 some years ago, and sending out postcard ballots and hoping that the right percentage of people would send back their preferences.
Yeah, but are polling techniques getting more sophisticated and
better?
Well,
they certainly are.
It just seems like, how can they get it this wrong? And so, I mean, this is sort of a fallacy of you know, what's just happened seems to be the dominant way things have gone. But it does seem to be remarkable that they've been getting it wrong a lot, even though in theory they should be getting better.
Right. And I think it's important to keep in mind, too, that not all presidential elections are marred by polling failure. But enough of them are for us to be kind of wary about them and say, let's treat this with a degree of skepticism. This is not the oracle. These are not prophecies. And the tendency is to treat them as such. You know, the polls are saying, the polls are doing, and you know, it's hard to escape them because there are so many, and journalists rely so heavily on polls to craft the dominant narrative of the campaign, of what the campaign dynamics are like, who's ahead, who's lagging behind, and so forth.
Well, it's almost as if they can never improve perfectly because the conditions change every single time very extensively.
That's right. Every presidential election is different, and every presidential election has qualitative differences that make it very difficult for pollsters to tap into exactly with high precision the outcomes. It's a rare presidential election not to have a polling controversy of some kind or another, and we have one in 2020. So that confirms the reality that polling controversies are attached to almost every presidential election campaign. And I can't go back in time and think of any presidential election that didn't have some sort of polling controversy or dispute attached to it. It's sort of comes with the territory now. But polling is more sophisticated. I mean, the techniques that are being used and the experimentation in the field, I mean, it's actually pretty impressive. They just haven't found the new gold standard for polling. The gold standard used to be random digit dialed telephone call using live operators. And that was introduced in the late 60s, early 70s, and it became the way that pollsters were doing election polling. And it was an effective device into the 70s and 80s and even 90s. Not to say that there weren't polling errors, because
sure,
the
yeah,
1980
yeah.
presidential election was a mistake, a major failure. But nonetheless, this approach really had revolutionized polling. And it took pollsters away from the door-to-door approach that had characterized their work for many, many years. And it made them, you know, they were being able to get these large samples done pretty quickly with a high degree of response rates. And these days, telephone polling is very difficult to do. It's very expensive to do. The response rates are really low, maybe 6, 7, 8%.
And nobody wants to talk on the phone anymore. It's practically impossible
to
get...
And the same with the cell phones. If you see a number, the pollsters can reach cell phone users. A little more expensive, a little more time consuming, but they can. But if you have a landline or a cell phone and you see a number that you don't recognize, what's the likelihood that you're going to answer it? Pretty small. generally speaking. And that's the problem that, that pollsters face with the telephone-based surveys nowadays. So there is no new gold standard, and there's a lot of effort by a lot of creative and smart people trying to find what is the best, next, most reliable technique. And maybe there isn't going to be a single technique. Maybe it's going to be a number of different modes, as they call them. And the internet has long been a beguiling platform for pollsters who think, gosh, there's got to be a way to tap the power of the internet to really come up with a good approach to doing reliable sampling. And they can use the internet to recruit samples or to recruit panels of respondents to whom pollsters go back time and again or several times in a campaign, let's say, to get their sense of what things are looking like. And the Pew Research Organization here in Washington makes extensive use of internet panels in their polling, mostly on public policy issues. So that is one approach, and yet there's still a lot of discrepancy. There's still a lot of debate about whether the internet is really going to be an answer for pollsters. It may offer some options, but whether it's going to become a gold standard of some sort, who knows? But there is an awful lot of research and experimentation going on in the field these days, and I expect that to continue.
Right. But I sort of have two questions and concerns, because they both relate to the sort of human nature in reading things and trying to analyze things. And the first thing is the kind of the newness or the freshness or the best new kid on the block pollster. So, for instance, for the longest time, I mean, I suppose after the Dewey thing went away, Gallup was the gold standard. But then until 2016, you know, remember for a couple of elections or a couple of decades, Nate Silver and 538.com were suddenly the geniuses. And then, boom, 2016 happened. So I'm wondering if we overlatch onto the people we think have discovered the Holy Grail, but who in fact haven't.
Great question. And we have seen in presidential elections past how pollsters rise to the top and have done extraordinarily well in pegging the outcome of the election. They're kind of hailed by their fellow pollsters as the winner of the polling derby, if you will. And there is nothing official about a polling derby in presidential elections, but in the sense that they are recognized as having gotten it right or closer to the mark than others. John Zogby was the guy who did that in the mid-90s, the 1996 election, and then again in 2000. He came in pretty close to the outcome. And in 1996, pollsters were way off, many of them. Although Bill Clinton was recognized as a sure and likely winner of that race against Bob Dole, many pollsters aimed high in 1996. Oh, okay. And they were like 10 points off from what the outcome was. CBS News had Clinton ahead by 18 points, and he won by 8.5. I mean, it's a comfortable, sizable victory, but it wasn't the blowout that had been expected by some pollsters. Zogby got it pretty close. He had Clinton ahead by 8 points, and Clinton won by 8.5. So Zogby was celebrated for a time as the best pollster of the year kind of thing. Again, it wasn't a specific award or honor.
No, yeah, but it's kind of like
terms, but yeah, informally. And then he did again pretty good again in 2000, which was a real controversial election. Of course, it wasn't decided for 37 days after the after Election Day.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
This is the Bush-Gore race. Zogby kind of did himself in 2004 by coming out on Election Day with a new estimate that showed Kerry going to win easily with more than 300 electoral votes, and it was going to be a near blowout for John Kerry. Zogby says he wasn't influenced by the exit polls that were being distributed that day, but nonetheless, he came out with a revised estimate that had Kerry clearly in the lead, and he lost. Kerry lost.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Zogby's aura was dented, at least in that election. So the point here is that some pollsters can rise and then some can fall in terms of their successes. You know, Rasmussen reports got it pretty close in 2016, had Hillary Clinton ahead at the end by 2 points, or by 3 points. Rasmussen reports had Clinton ahead by 3 points at the end of the campaign in 2016, and she won the popular vote that year by 2.1 percentage points. So Rasmussen came in pretty close. And, you know, he was touting himself as, you know, essentially the best pollster of that campaign. But, and I think he had Trump ahead by 1 point at the end of the 2020 campaign. And he looks like that was a little low. So the fortunes of pollsters can ebb and flow fairly dramatically. And it is it can be a gut-wrenching business to be in election polling.
Well, the final thing I would ask, and if you allow me one more analogy, is one of the points you keep making throughout the book, and you've made in a lot of your articles, of course, and something that people seem to always forget about, is this snapshot in time. And I just want to make this analogy because I happen to be working on a show for Christmas about Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, and suppose this internet meme that's going around that he was shell-shocked in World War II, and that's why he was able to call up all these emotions in that movie anyway. And a lot of these, it turns out that's not true, but anyway, there's a lot of these analyses, and I see this all the time in history, and especially all the time in sort of popular everyday conversations, is they'll look at a photograph of somebody, which is taken at a shutter speed of 1/500th of a second, and the person looks glum or dour or drawn or gaunt or whatever, or like the famous Che Guevara picture looks, you know, stolid and revolutionary, but then could in the next half a second be joking around and laughing, and it's almost as if people want to read into that 1/500th of a second a whole analysis about us, about what someone is going through at the time. And it's a fallacy I run into again and again and again. And I often wonder if the journalists, if this journalistic error in taking the pollsters too literally isn't sort of the same thing or very similar thing.
Professor, I love your analogies. These are great.
No, sorry. And, sorry.
The Jimmy Stewart story, that's, it sounds almost too good to be true, and you say it's probably a myth.
Yeah, it is almost certainly a myth, and we're still working on it. We have, you know, back in the basement of the Buskill Institute, we've got researchers cranking away on the problem. But people seem to draw so much out of some, you know, milliseconds, and they'll snapshot in time. And I'm sorry to keep saying snapshot in time, but that's what they are.
That's what pollsters say. They say, many of them say, our polls are snapshots of a given moment. They are not predictions. But you know, Professor, I find that to be a bit of a cop-out.
Oh.
I think pollsters take refuge in this notion that these are snapshots, they're not predictions, for a couple of reasons, at least. If you take enough snapshots, you're going to get a whole panorama,
aren't you, of what
the presidential campaign or election campaign is looking like. And it's not just a one-off snapshot. It is a snapshot that is taken over and over and over again of this landscape, of this presidential election panorama. And so you're constantly updating with more snapshots what the election is looking like. And the closer you get to an election, the more those snapshots are in real sharp focus. And the succession of variety of photographs offered by other pollsters is going to together collectively add up to something close to a prediction. So I think pollsters do themselves a injustice by saying, these are not predictions. I think it's a cop-out. I think they like to find refuge from critics in this notion that these are not predictions, they are snapshots. And this is information that they put together and they put out that's very valuable to have and circulate in a democratic society. It's important to know who's ahead, and it's important to know who's behind. And what policy issues and discussion points are really resonating with people. So polling does is really, really, really very important in terms of giving us an indication as to what's going on, a clue, a sharp, somewhat precise clue as to how an election is going to unfold. And to get that right is really very incumbent on pollsters. And to take refuge in this notion, oh, it's just a snapshot, don't worry about it, you know, is, I think, as I say, a bit of a cop-out. Plus, pollsters, when they get it close to spot on, they love to crow about
that's
it, too,
right.
Frankly.
Yeah, right.
You know, George Gallup, back 80 years ago in the Wendell Willkie, Franklin Roosevelt campaign, his polling was pretty close. I mean, he pointed to the right winner, that Franklin Roosevelt won a third term in 1940. And Gallup, after the election, takes out this double-truck ad in Editor and Publisher magazine, the trade journal of of journalists. And the double truck, of course, is an ad that runs on both pages, both facing pages, and proclaiming the accuracy, the record-setting accuracy of the Gallup poll. So pollsters have this long and deep tradition of crowing when they get it right, but they seem to be reluctant to say, well, you know, this is really not a prediction. This is a snapshot in time.
Yeah. And they're certainly not averse to the praise they get when they get it.
Precisely.
Nate Silver doesn't go out and say, now, wait a minute, folks, you know, there's a lot of subtlety here.
Yeah. Well, and he hedges a fair amount. And I think you have to in statistical analysis. You can't, it's not, you used the electron example early in the show, and I think it's true. I mean, this is not the precision of that kind of science. Polling is a lot more art than science sometimes. And one of those elements is when, how you determine who the likely voter is going to be. And there's all kinds of methods that pollsters use to weed out people who say they're going to vote but probably aren't. And that can, if you include too many non-likely voters in your sample, that can screw up your results. And that may have been a factor in the 2020 surprise that we've seen. But the point is here that polling can be a lot of art as well as some science.
And we should treat it more like art.
I think so. I think we should treat polls warily, skeptically, realizing that these are imperfect measures, these are imperfect instruments, and that they have gone wrong in the past. The trouble is that many people, journalists, pollsters even, and many Americans, don't know the history of polling failure in presidential elections in this country. And they may have a vague sense of, well, yeah, there was the Dewey defeats Truman election in 1948. I've seen the photograph of Truman holding up the Chicago Tribune that proclaimed Dewey defeats Truman. The most singularly most impressive and most memorable, probably, photograph in political journalism in this country. So there may be a vague recollection of that, Dewey defeats Truman, but not much else. So the history of polling failure and its varieties and its many typologies is a history that is not well known. And I think Americans would do well to understand that history a little bit better.
Well, Professor, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a great, not only explanation of what you talk about in Lost in a Gallup, which is, of course, your new book from the University of California Press that we've put on the Buzzkill bookshelf for Buzzkillers to get, but it also makes us think about what just happened. And then presumably we need to think and maybe treat this more as an art when 2022 and 2024 come around and on and on and on. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and putting up with my analogies.
I loved them. And Professor, it was really a pleasure. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay. We'll say to all the buzzkillers out there that we will talk to all of you next week.